I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In his latest book, the renowned legal scholar Floyd Abrams calls the First Amendment the rock star of the U.S. Constitution. For generations, censorship and statutes banning criticism of the government held sway. But since the middle of the 20th century, America's embrace of the right to free expression and a free press has far exceeded that of Europe and other democracies in its intensity and scope. But as Abrams points out, having First Amendment rights doesn't answer the question of how to use them. Floyd Abrams joins me to talk about the soul of the First Amendment. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews An American in Paris at Baltimore's Hippodrome Theater. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to have a conversation about American exceptionalism as regards our cherished tradition of free speech. The First Amendment to the Constitution states in part that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. In his latest book, which explores the legacy and future of free speech, the acclaimed legal scholar Floyd Abrams argues that while we share many legal values with Canada, Europe, and other democracies, the United States stands alone in its vigorous protection of freedom of expression, language that President Donald Trump uses regularly to describe immigrants, Muslims, and others would be considered criminal conduct in much of Europe. So why is it that since the mid-20th century, Americans have moved so aggressively to protect even the most vile hate speech, ignoring the worth of any speech in favor of the right of citizens to say it? Floyd Abrams is considered by many to be the preeminent scholar on the subject of free expression and freedom of the press. He successfully argued at the Supreme Court what many consider the two most consequential First Amendment cases in American history. In 1971, he defended the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, and in 2010, he won the Citizens United case, which dramatically altered laws concerning corporate spending in political campaigns. Floyd Abrams' latest book is called The Soul of the First Amendment, and it's just out in paperback. Mr. Abrams is a senior partner in the New York law firm of Cahill, Gordon, and Rindell. He has also taught at Yale and Columbia law schools, and he joins us on the phone today from his office in New York. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
So you write and you remind us that the Founding Fathers had some disagreement originally about even adding any amendments to the Constitution. The first vote that took place to add what became the Bill of Rights and the first nine amendments was 10-0 against it. But they eventually got around to doing it. And you call the First Amendment of the Constitution the rock star of the Constitution. How come?
Well, I guess because it's the best known, the most cited in the U.S. And abroad, I mean, in other democratic countries, which, as you said a moment ago, they don't go at all as far as we do in protecting free speech. But nonetheless, they recognize and sometimes look to and sometimes reject just how far we have gone as a legal matter in protecting free speech. But it has been treated, and I think rightly treated, as sort of a special jewel of the Constitution. You know, when the Constitution was written in Philadelphia back at the end of the 18th century, the Revolutionary War had been won, but the states operating under the Articles of Confederation were really all more or less independent bodies. There was no federal coinage. There was no federal army. There was no president. So there were 13 states, and they had fought together and won the war. They drafted laboriously this Constitution, and the argument against having a Bill of Rights was led by, of all people, Alexander Hamilton. who basically said, and this is like a lawyer's argument, but basically said, why should we start listing all the things Congress can't do? They can't do anything other than the things we've said they can do. And if we start listing, we're going to forget things, and the future generations will think we didn't care about anything other than what we listed. So Hamilton argued, let's just leave it straight and not have amendments of this sort at all. And that was overcome. I mean, Jefferson in France and other people in the U.S. argued it is essential for any free people to say in so many words in their founding document that the government can't deprive people of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and the like.
And you write that central to democracy is defining these kinds of freedoms in the negative rather than the positive.
Yeah.
Give us an example of what you mean. There are some constitutions, that of North Korea, for example, and Eritrea, who try to define freedom of expression in positive terms. It's interesting that the United States Constitution does it in a negative term. Congress shall not abridge. So tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, what they were doing really was sort of emphasizing the limits of the power of the then new federal government. And what they wanted to make clear was that the government can't do these things. One of the problems with having affirmative articulations, and it's not just repressive states, that even though I mention them in my book, that have them, but one of the problems is that there's a tendency to treat constitutions around the world as if they were aspirational, as if they were articulations of how it would be good if people behaved. To make it its most extravagant, as if they were poetry, like parts of the Declaration of Independence are. And it was very important, in my view, and certainly in the view of the framers, to try to couch as clearly as they could, this is a legal document. I mean, this is not what we hope will happen. These are the limits, or at least these are the limits we are placing on this new and potentially very powerful federal government.
And it's interesting that you also remind us that the First Amendment for a couple of hundred years of our republic really had very little prominence in legal proceedings. It really wasn't until the 1940s that the First Amendment sort of came into its own. Prior to that, censorship and repressing speech one way or another was a commonplace thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was really quite normal. We had movie censorship. We had a lot of book censorship. We had theatrical censorship of a sort that would just be unthinkable today. I would say it really not till World War I, when socialists started to be jailed for opposing the war, were there cases in which there was a serious back and forth. And in most of those cases, what I'll call the First Amendment side lost, but they are cases in which Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes started dissenting, and dissenting in tones that would later, well after, say, the 1920s, that would later carry the day. But that really wasn't, as you said, until well into the 20th century. I mean, one example, there was no statute held unconstitutional based on the First Amendment until 1965.
Yeah, so First Amendment cases, which now seem to be quite commonplace, were simply unheard of. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
The book is called The Soul of the First Amendment. My guest is its author, Floyd Abrams. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Mr. Abrams, there's a question here on email. I was going to save it for later, but John has written it right off the top, so let's get to it. He says, the First Amendment primarily protects against censorship by the government. The most difficult First Amendment problems today are with private entities. Like Twitter and Facebook. So how does the First Amendment apply, or does it ever apply to private entities?
Yeah. I mean, your questioner is quite right in saying, and I'll say it even more broadly, the First Amendment only applies to the government. I mean, it's not just primarily, only. So Facebook is free to do what it chooses. Facebook is indeed protected by the First Amendment. Google is protected by the First Amendment, and their decisions about what to carry and what not. And so you want...
And we have apparently lost Mr. Abrams, so why don't we take a quick break? We will come back and rediscover Mr. Abrams from his office in New York. The book is called The Soul of the First Amendment. Floyd Abrams is the guy that defended the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. He also successfully prosecuted a case that turned out to be very controversial, that of Citizens United, which in many people's opinion sort of opened the floodgates for nefarious contributions to political campaigns and the timing of those contributions. We'll talk about all of that when we come back from a break. You are welcome to join us. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday at wipr.org. Our Twitter handle at @MiddayWIPR. Thanks for being with us. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this very hot day here in Baltimore. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's the Midday News Wrap. Malaya Cromer, the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College, will discuss results from the latest Goucher poll in the race for governor here in Maryland. And we'll take a look at some of the top stories in the news this week with Malaya, as well as Maisha Rasko of NPR and Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun. So that's all coming up tomorrow on the Midday News Wrap. If you're just joining us today, the First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, The Soul of the First Amendment. That's the amendment that guarantees freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the freedom to assemble, and the freedom to petition the government with grievances. The book is now out in paperback. And by the way, today happens to be World Press Freedom Day, an initiative of the United Nations in which tribute is paid to journalists around the world who have lost their lives on the job. And you'll recall that just this week, 10 journalists died in Afghanistan. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at @MiddayWIPR. Mr. Abrams, I'm sorry we had a little technical difficulty there and we lost you for a second.
Oh, sure.
But when we talk about how the government is the only one restrained by the First Amendment, what's your reaction, for example, last week when this comedian Michelle Wolf appeared and did a set at the White House Correspondents' Dinner? And there were plenty of people, particularly on the political right, who called her speech indecent. And there were even people calling for the Secret Service to rip her off the stage in the middle of her set. What was your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, we're fortunate that we live in a country in which that's not something the Secret Service does. This is, in general, part of the same First Amendment schema that I referred to earlier. The government simply isn't in the picture. A private organization, the White House Correspondents Association, asked her to speak. I think some of them were surprised and some of them were unhappy, although when you ask a comedian who does certain sorts of humor, to speak. I don't know why anybody was surprised that she would speak in that way. But in any event, they were free to invite her. There was no legal risk for her or for them in her speaking. There is a public policy issue, if you will, or an issue about is it a good thing for journalists to invite someone who's going to so antagonize so many people in the public? Or indeed, is it a good thing for journalists to have chosen, instead of talking more about world press freedom and all the journalists who have been killed around the world, to mingle with their sources? I mean, those are genuine issues. They're issues that very serious journalists and others argue about and disagree on. But the First Amendment side of it is, first, that there's no government role in deciding that. Now, there's one other thing, and that's what I would call First Amendment values, which is to say, not what First Amendment law is, but what is it that the First Amendment protects, which is valuable. One of the things is criticism of government. In good part, that's what she was doing. Now, it may have been a bad decision by the White House Correspondents Association to invite someone who would choose in the language she used to attack, criticize, even mock the president. What the First Amendment brings to the table on that is simply that in America you're allowed to do that. You can mock the president in public on television in a very harsh and clear and unambiguous fashion.
Right, and you remind us that the First Amendment values avoid censorship without regard to the worth of the speech. So hate speech is protected.
Yeah.
In so-called indecent speech is protected. And that, I guess, the premise behind that is that the more speech we have, the better informed the public will be, and therefore democracy will remain vibrant. But in the context of, you know, alleged Russian involvement in disinformation, for example, in the 2016 presidential campaign, that's more speech, but it's speech that is, the argument can certainly be made, is quite deleterious to the democratic values of the republic.
Oh yes, and more. I think it would be constitutional to require that, for example, advertisements on Facebook have to disclose who is paying for them, which is the law now about the radio and television. I mean, it's not that the First Amendment is a complete open book where the government can have no role at all about anything to do with speech. Also, look, we do have a body of law that says that foreign countries are not allowed to spend money on American elections.
So transparency and disclosure of who was behind those ads would have shown them to be in violation of U.S. law, consistent with the First Amendment and other statutes then.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, quite right.
And when it comes to disclosure and transparency, one of the celebrated cases in which you were involved, very controversial, was the Citizens United case. We have a listener who has a question about it. I have a couple myself. Let's ask David in Pikesville to join us and pose your question to Floyd Abrams. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Mr. Abrams. Do you agree that the Citizens United case changed our country from a democracy into an oligarchy?
No, I don't. Here's what I think. I think that the notion of saying that it can be criminal for an entity, in this case a conservative entity, partially funded by corporations, to prepare and put on television or cable a sort of documentary denouncing, in that case, Hillary Clinton, when it looked like she would be the Democratic candidate for president. The idea that that can be criminal does seem to me to violate the First Amendment. I think that you are right, or to put it differently, I agree with you that we have a problem. I don't think it's a Citizens United problem. We have a problem with economic and therefore political inequality in this country. But I don't believe the way to do that, the way to deal with that, is to limit speech, and in particular, to limit speech about who should be elected to public office. The way to deal with that, to deal with what I view as an economic problem, is to deal with it economically, deal with it with tax laws, deal with it with antitrust laws, deal with it with a variety of other ways. But I am of the view that you ought not to try to deal with it by limiting the amount of speech, either in general or by speaker.
And Mr. Abrams, when you were arguing it, and when the majority of the court, the Roberts Court, decided it, were they aware, were you aware of the likely consequences of a decision to basically, upend several tenets of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law? Were you concerned that it would, in fact, do what it has done, which is sort of unleash this, amazing amount of special interest spending in U.S. elections by a very small percentage of the public? I mean, 0.01% of Americans contributed more than 28% of the money spent in the 2012 elections, 2 years after Citizens United. It has completely changed the calculus of politics here. These super PACs, their creation happened after Citizens United. Were these unintended consequences, or were they consequences that everybody knew were going to happen?
I think I have two answers. First, I don't think anybody predicted or could know the entirety of the results of Citizens United. Second, it is not the case that vast new amounts of corporate money, in this case it was about whether corporations could have the same rights as individuals to spend or expenditure unlimited amounts of money. Corporate involvement has been far less than I think anyone expected. The editorials and the papers denouncing the Citizens United opinion predicted waves of corporate money coming in. That has not happened. And we know to the dollar, with respect to super PACs, exactly how much has been spent. And it is far, far more by individuals. I mean, for example, the data from the 2016-2017, which we now have, indicates that in all federal elections, something like a billion and a quarter, maybe $1.5 billion, were spent on elections by individuals, and $80 million in total in all those elections spent by corporations. And that doesn't mean that there's no problem on an egalitarian level with how much individual money is being spent. But I think that's the argument we ought to be having rather than about corporations, because corporations have basically made decisions that in good part because these expenditures must be disclosed, they choose not to spend money there. They do spend money on lobbying and other political activities, but it is not really on a broad level enormous sums in a country this big.
But
with Yeah, go on.
But sir, I mean, isn't it also the case, whether it, and corporation in this case is defined by both for-profit and non-profit. These super PACs are non-profit. But is regardless of the amount that is spent by individuals or corporate entities of one type or another, isn't the problem transparency? The fact that there's so much dark money. I mean, in 2014, 2 years before this last presidential election, 40% of the ads in that election were purchased by dark money groups. We didn't know who was purchasing it, although we could probably guess fairly well. And the majority in the opinion of the Supreme Court basically said they're independent of these candidates, therefore they can spend their money however they want. But as a practical matter, are they really independent of the candidates and their platforms?
Look, I think the Federal Election Commission, which is basically non-functional, should have and has the power to enforce these statutes much more than they have. The advertisements that you're talking about are, for the most part, organizations like the National Chamber of Commerce, or ones which include the NRA, for example. We have a pretty good idea who's funding what. I think we should have more of an idea, and it would not violate the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court didn't say it would violate. Indeed, the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, has made very clear that disclosure requirements are almost always constitutional and indeed consistent with the First Amendment. The problem there is Congress, not the courts, and not the interpretation by the courts of the First Amendment. So we have Congress that has refused to step in, we have the judicial system, which, you know, has simply said, well, whatever Congress says on the disclosure level is very likely to be constitutional.
Well, then, I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
That it's your contention that if the Congress or the Federal Election Commission were to either enforce current law or create laws that required more transparency, those laws would not be, or they would be, rather, let me phrase this affirmatively, they would be constitutional under the Citizens United ruling?
Yeah, look, the Citizens United Court affirmed by an 8-1 vote the constitutionality of the disclosure requirements in front of them. Only Justice Thomas dissented from that. So there were 8 votes sustaining everything that was before the court about transparency. And in case after case in the Supreme Court and lower courts, transparency requirements have been affirmed. Now, you know, we have states like New York. I've been involved on the behalf of Governor Cuomo in New York, which are requiring more in the way of donor disclosures to entities, 501c3s and 501c4s. Those statutes are constitutional, and if we could get Congress to be more forthright about requiring more disclosure, I don't have any doubt that those statutes would pass, and more important, would be affirmed by the Supreme Court in the same sort of language they've been using, that it serves the public interest, and it is very important for the public to know who's paying for the speech which envelops us around election time.
Floyd Abrams, the book is called The Soul of the First Amendment. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. Mr. Abrams, we have a note from David who emails us. There's already on the books a body of law governing organizations like schools that act in loco parentis. Is it possible that future law could evolve governing corporations that are so powerful that they can act in the place of or the role of the government through monopolistic ownership of platforms like, again, Twitter and Facebook? Do you envision, as David perhaps does, Mr. Abrams, the law evolving so that corporations are limited more stringently than they currently are?
I don't think that we could have a law in which the government plays a sort of oversight role, but we could have much stronger antitrust laws. I mean, when you talk about the power of certain companies, we do have antitrust laws which deal with monopolization, which deal with agreements among entities to raise prices, divide markets, I mean, a whole lot of things. Those are constitutional. They've been held to be constitutional. They could go farther. I suspect with a different administration, they would go farther. I mean, I look to the future and I ask myself, what's going to happen to Facebook? Mr. Zuckerberg testifies under pressure, one could say, but nonetheless, saying we accept the fact that regulation is needed. And the question of what sort of regulation will be an absolutely central one in terms of what information the public gets in the future about the entities which provide more of news, as I said earlier, more information, more data, which affects how people think about public policy issues and who to vote for than any other. I mean, they aren't newspapers anymore. They are entities such as, but most of all, Facebook and Google and the like. And that's where I think a lot of the battles of the future are more likely to be fought than about other issues such as we've been talking about so far. And we don't know what the answer is going to be. I mean, we don't know what sort of regulation might be agreed upon. We don't know what sort of regulation Congress would consider or Facebook, to take it, might agree to or fight against. That's where a lot of the most important battles of the next years will be fought. And I think one of the areas where the public ought to devote its focus is to just what it wants of Facebook and Google. I mean, do you want it to be, as I was saying earlier, an entity at least a little more newspaper-like, so it has standards saying we don't carry racist speech, we don't carry speech which might influence someone on the terrorism side? Or do we want it to be more like telephones, where people can pretty much, you know, say anything they want, and, you know, and have their say without virtually any oversight?
And are Facebook and Google answerable to the public in that? Or are they simply obligated to answer to their shareholders?
Right. Well, we don't know the on-the-ground answer to that yet, because for one thing, the public has been very supportive of Facebook and Google and the like. I mean, the public has participated, enjoyed, and to some extent learned from these still new institutions.
Yeah, to the tune of 2.9 billion subscribers to Facebook.
Right? Unbelievable, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, those numbers are would have been unthinkable not many years ago. Do I think public opinion will matter? I really do about Facebook and Google and the like. I mean, I don't think these entities are going to, what should I say, take absolute hardline positions. They sort of, you know, it's our company and we can do whatever we want. They want public support and are concerned when the public seems to have some level of concern about their behavior. And again, I think that's a big time area in which we're going to have a lot of battles in the future. Now, in some of them, I mean, one that I've been writing about very recently is the so-called right to be forgotten. I mean, throughout Western Europe, it is now the case that if somebody has been written about in Google some years back, And that which was said about the person is viewed as, quote, no longer relevant, unquote, he or she can write to Google and say, take my name down.
Even if it's true, right? You're right, the truth is no defense. So even if you write something that is true, but if the person is embarrassed by it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There was a decision just 2 weeks ago in England about a man who'd been convicted of engaging in a sort of too close surveillance of people who worked at 11 media institutions. He was jailed for 6 months for violating an English law. It was over 10 years ago. He asked Google to delete his name. They said no. He went to court, and the High Court in England just 2 weeks ago ruled that Google had to take it down, saying, well, it's no longer relevant. He hasn't done anything bad since then. There's no reason to think he will do anything illegal in the future. Now, that would clearly violate the First Amendment here. But it is the law throughout Western Europe, where they are, call it what you will, more privacy-oriented and less free speech-oriented than we are, and in any event, are quite prepared to and are cracking down on Google's ability or the legality of Google simply carrying material which had been in newspapers a certain number of years ago.
You're right that having First Amendment rights doesn't answer the question of how to use them. And you talk about Edward Snowden, yeah. Chelsea Manning. You defended Daniel Ellsberg back in 1971. WikiLeaks, those kinds of disclosures, many times the disclosures of this classified information led to putting agents and counteragents and all sorts of personnel worldwide in danger. How should we only have a couple of minutes left here, sir. How do we frame that understanding of the right to have that information versus the protecting government interest?
Well, two things. First, we have an espionage law. It's very old, 1917. It's phrased very broadly. And the Obama administration, they thought very seriously, of indictments for some of the revelations by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They decided not to do it because they couldn't sort of come up with a theory that would not at least risk being applicable to the Washington Post and the New York Times also. And that's a big problem. But there are, even in a country with a broad First Amendment, some things, atomic secrets, how to build certain types of weapons, which are illegal to print or to reveal. Now, those are fortunately very narrow areas, but I wouldn't be surprised if this administration were to one of these days take a look at the espionage law and start using it in ways that could be very dangerous.
Well, we're going to have to call it there. You do make the point, you quote George Orwell, who says that if large numbers of people are interested in freedom of speech, there will be freedom of speech. So this is something that we certainly hope everybody will be interested in. And I appreciate your time today and enjoyed reading your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
The First Amendment lawyer and legal scholar Floyd Abrams, he successfully argued both the Pentagon Papers case as well as the Citizens United case at the Supreme Court. He's the author of The Soul of the First Amendment, now out in paperback. By the way, speaking of the First Amendment, May 17th will mark the 50th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, Catholic activists who burned hundreds of draft records to protest the Vietnam War. Catonsville Nine are being commemorated this month in a series of events at UMBC, including a symposium tomorrow that features Marjorie Melville, who is one of the surviving members of the Catonsville Nine. And next week, the Maryland Historical Society will open its latest exhibition called Activism and Art, with a screening of a documentary film by Lynn Sachs called Investigation of a Flame. There's going to be a reception and community discussion after that screening on Saturday, the 12th of May. We'll have more information about those events on our website, wypr.org/midday. When we come back after a short break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews An American in Paris at the Hippodrome Theater here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.